That psalm, like so many of the psalms, was written at a time when the psalmist was deeply distressed. He speaks in the psalm about the enemies who were making his life a misery. Talks in verse 7 about his foes. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. There were people who hated him, who in one way or another were attacking him. These were wicked men, evil men. And verse 8, away from me, all you who do evil. Describes them again in verse 10 as all my enemies. We don't know exactly what these people were doing, how they were attacking him. But it's a horrible thing when you have people and you know that they hate you and you know that they're trying to destroy you. That was the position he was in. And the stress of this situation was making him ill. His mind was continually troubled. He talks in verse 3 about his soul, by which he just means his mind, his psyche. My soul is in anguish. There are things going round and round in his mind all the time. He just feels wretched. And he can't sleep at night. He's lying awake and crying all through the night. He says it in verse 6, I'm worn out from groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. He's reached the stage where he's just sobbing constantly, where he breaks down again and again and again. He just can't cope with the pressures. And this is making him physically ill. In verse 2, he says, my bones are in agony. His physical frame is under such stress. His enemies attacking him from outside. His physical frame breaking down. His mind and his soul in anguish. But beyond all this, there's another factor. And it's this, that he's aware of the fact that it is God who has brought this upon him. We're not saying that it's God who stirred up the wickedness in the hearts of his enemies, but we are saying that God is in control. And the psalmist knows that these enemies would not have been able to attack him in this way if God had not allowed them to. He's conscious of the fact that if he's being attacked in this way, if he's under such stress, it must be that God has brought this upon him. And there is in his mind the dreadful fear that God has done this, that God has put him in this situation because God is angry with him. Maybe he's troubled by the thought of sins that he's committed in the past. Maybe he's just conscious of the fact that in many ways his life is not pleasing to God. And so he's asking himself all the time, is it that God's angry with me? He's striking me with one blow after another. He's putting me through such pain. He's rebuking me. He's chastening me. Is it because he's angry? That's the situation in which the psalmist writes this psalm. In the beginning of the psalm, he's pleading with God. He's pleading with God, do not rebuke me in your anger. Please don't discipline me in your wrath. Be merciful to me. Please heal me, he says. Turn, O Lord, and deliver me. He's just pleading with God repeatedly. Please bring me out of this situation. Please lift me out of the pain that I'm in. please let my mind return to normal. Please let my body recover. He describes his tragic state. I'm sure the Lord knows all about it already, but he wants to tell the Lord just how much he's hurting. Yes, the Lord was there all through those nights when he was crying, but he still feels he needs to tell the Lord about how he's been crying every night. And then he returns to the appeal. And then he goes back to the description. Then he returns to the appeal. And then he goes back to the description. This is a man wrestling with God, pleading with God, invoking God's pity. And then there comes a moment when he's sure that God has heard his prayer. He comes to a point where he is confident that God is going to transform the situation. He believes that somehow or other, these wicked men who are afflicting him are going to be swept from the scene, that they're going to be left ashamed and dismayed, that they're going to turn back in disgrace. He's expecting them to be humiliated, ashamed. He's expecting them to be totally defeated in this situation. And the psalmist finishes on a note of great and bold confidence. All my enemies will be ashamed and dismayed. They will turn back in sudden disgrace. Or as we put it in the sung version, my foes disgraced shall all retreat in sudden, shameful, sure defeat. He's confident of that. Now, that is what we have here in the psalm. I would have to say that the things we've picked out in the psalm, you would find in many, many of the psalms. The psalms are full of examples of distress and pain. In, I would think, the majority of the psalms, the psalmist is pleading with God because he's in pain physically and mentally. Very often it's because enemies are attacking. Very often he describes the distress that he's feeling. And very often he does win through to confident, bold certainty that God is going to intervene, or that God has intervened. All the things we've traced out in this psalm could be found in many other psalms as well. So what is the distinctive feature of this psalm? What is the thing that makes this psalm special, that makes it unique? Well, let me put the question in this way. What is the most important word in this psalm? What is the word that leaps off the page as we read through the psalm? It's a word that's found again in many, many other psalms. It's been found in all the psalms we've been through thus far, Psalms 1 to 5. But it appears so many times in this psalm. There is such a dense concentration of use of this one word. 8 times in the 10 verses of this psalm, the psalmist talks to or about the Lord. That's the striking feature of this psalm, that the psalmist here in this psalm is intensely conscious that he's speaking to the Lord. And he's intensely conscious of what that means. Now, what does that mean? Notice, I'll just show you the 8 occasions. Verse 1. O Lord, do not rebuke me. Verse 2, be merciful to me, O Lord. O Lord, heal me. Verse 3, how long, O Lord? Verse 4, turn, O Lord. Verse 8, the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry. Verse 9, the Lord accepts my prayer. On each of those occasions, you will notice, if you haven't already, that the word Lord is printed in capital letters. That's a decision the translators have made. They've printed the word Lord in each case in capital letters. And they've done that to inform you of what the Hebrew word is that they're translating. You might think that Lord just means master, boss, chief. But it's not that that you've got in the Hebrew. What you've got is a name. The name of God. It's just four letters in the Hebrew. YHWH. They don't put in the vowels between the letters. It would be pronounced something like Yahweh. Whenever you get the word Lord in capital letters in the Old Testament, what you've got in the Hebrew is the word Yahweh. So we could have read the psalm through in this way: O Yahweh, do not rebuke me in your anger. Be merciful to me, Yahweh. How long, Yahweh, how long? Turn, O Yahweh, and deliver me. Away from me, all you who do evil, for Yahweh has heard my weeping. Yahweh has heard my cry for mercy. Yahweh accepts my prayer. This psalmist knows God's name, his personal name. He knows God by name, and he speaks to God by name. And he understands what that name means. What does that name mean? Well, we read earlier, didn't we, from Exodus chapter 3. We read about Moses meeting with God out in the wilderness of Sinai. This was Moses' first real encounter with God. And it was then and then that God explained his name to Moses. Do you remember in Exodus chapter 3, God says this to Moses in verse 6. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God introduces himself to Moses as a God who enters into relationships with people. And he says, I'm the God who has a relationship with your forefather Abraham. And I'm the God who has a relationship with your forefather Isaac. I'm the God who has a relationship with your forefather Jacob. I'm the God who enters into relationships with people, and then those relationships are never broken. The point is that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob had been dead for centuries. And yet God is still saying, I am their God. I belong to them. They belong to me. The relationship I have with them still goes on. Isn't that extraordinary? That here is Moses and he's meeting this God whom he doesn't know. And this God says, you can know me because I'm the sort of God who enters into relationships with people. I entered into relationship with your great, 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 great granddad and his son and his son. And those relationships still stand. I'm still their God. But that had other implications then. Because God had made promises to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. God had promised that he would always bless their seed, their descendants. And Moses is one of them. God had promised that the bond he had with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would be a bond he would have with their descendants. So when God says to Moses, I'm the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, he's also saying, I'm your God. The relationship I have with them puts me into a relationship with you. Moses is given work to do for God. God tells him he's got to go back to Egypt and to call the Israelites to leave Egypt, to come out to be God's people. Moses is a little daunted by that task. And Moses asks God this question in verse 13. Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" And God said to Moses, "I am who I am. Don't try to find a name for me. I simply am. I simply am who I am." And then he says to Moses, "This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. If you need a name for me, that's the name you're to use. I am. Just remind them that I am who I am." And that means that I never change. If God simply is who he is, if he can call himself I am, he's saying I'm always the same. I never change. So if I was the God of your fathers, I'm still the God of your fathers. If I made promises to your fathers, those promises still stand. And if you're my people, you're my people forever. I am means I am the changeless one. I'm the eternal one. And then he said to Moses, verse 15, "Say to the Israelites, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you." And Yahweh simply means he is. It's the name I am turned into the third person. So when God says his name, he calls himself I am. When we speak about God and call him by name, we say he is. That's the name, the God by which God identified himself to Moses and the Israelites. He says, always think of me as he is. And always remember that what that means is that I'm the unchanging God. I'm the God who enters into relationships with people. And I'm a God then who keeps those relationships forever, because I don't change. Every time a Bible writer calls God Yahweh, that Bible writer is saying to God, "I know you are who you are. I know that you are the one who doesn't change. I know that you are the one who enters into relationships with people. And I know that once you've entered into a relationship with people, it stands, because you can't change." Do you understand what I mean when I talk about entering into a relationship with somebody? There are plenty of people with whom I interact, but with whom I have no relationship. If I go shopping on Castle Street, well, I may notice some familiar faces as I walk along. People whom I've seen on Castle Street before, people whom I've stood with at a bus stop, and I'll nod to them and they'll nod to me. We interact, but we wouldn't say that there's any relationship between us. Perhaps I go into one of the shops that I go into regularly, and it's the same girl on the till as it usually is, and we nod to one another, and she says, "Oh, nice weather we're having, isn't it?" And I say, "Oh, but they say it's going to change later on in the week." But there's no relationship between us. You can interact with any number of people, and yet there's no relationship between you and them. You wouldn't say that you're bound to them in any way. That girl who sells me the newspaper, She doesn't have any claims on me, and I don't have any claims on her. She's not obliged to do anything for me, I'm not obliged to do anything for her. It's simply a once-off interaction. But that's different, isn't it, from the way I relate to my family. If I see Jesse, or if I see my wife, or if I see another of my children, then I'm looking at somebody to whom I'm committed. There is a pledged relationship between us. There's a committed relationship between us. They have claims on me, and I have claims on them. There's an agreement, an understanding between us. Once and for all, I am Jesse's father. And he's my son. It's understood, it's fixed. I have a special relationship with the members of this church. They're my brothers and my sisters in a way that nobody else is. If I meet one of you on Castle Street, it's not like meeting a shopkeeper. I'm meeting somebody whom I'm committed to and who I know is committed to me. There's that fixed relationship between us. When God said, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and I'm your God now, Moses, and I'm now going to be the God of these people, he's saying, I have fixed relationships, bonded relationships, committed relationships. God interacts with all humanity. God sends his rain falling on good people and bad people, people indiscriminately. He makes the sun shine on people indiscriminately. He gives air for them all to breathe. He interacts with them all. But there are some people to whom he has bound himself with special relationships. There are some people of whom he can say, they are my people, and I am their God. We belong together. And because his name is Yahweh, because he is, because he doesn't change, once he has that sort of relationship with you, it is forever. Some of you can say, and say with certainty, I have that sort of relationship with God. He belongs to me. I belong to him. You entered it through Jesus Christ. The day you trusted yourself to Jesus Christ, you entered into an unbreakable covenant relationship with God. The God who made the universe became your father, and you became his child. From now on, you have the right to call him by his name. And the name by which we call him is even more precious than Yahweh. We call him Father. Eternally my Father. And because his name is Yahweh, he will always be my Father. He is. And he is who he is. And he can't be anything different. He can't change. The man who wrote this psalm, Psalm 6, was a man intensely conscious of the fact that he had a covenant relationship with God. He was a man who was intensely conscious that he had the right to call God Yahweh. He had the right to say to God, you are my God. Just as you are the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, you are my God. And it's forever. That's the great thing that underlies every word of Psalm 6. That here is a man who's aware of that special covenant relationship with God, and who believes and trusts in God as the God who doesn't change. Now, I just want to pick out briefly five things in this psalm then. Five things that the psalmist says which arise out of his covenant relationship with God. The first is this, that as somebody who has that sort of personal, family, covenant relationship with God, he expects rebuke and discipline. In verse 1 he says, O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, or discipline me in your wrath. He expects God to rebuke him and to discipline him, but he says, please don't do it in anger. The words rebuke and discipline are both family words. They're words that you would only use in the context of a relationship. You rebuke somebody you care about. You rebuke somebody you've got a link with, a bond with. You feel concerned about them, and so you give them a warning. As I'm walking along Castle Street, I don't feel obliged to rebuke every young person on Castle Street who I think is dressed scruffily. But I rebuke my children. And I don't think it is my place to discipline every person I meet. But I do discipline my children. And I do it out of care for them. I do it because I'm concerned about them. I do it because I want there to be nothing that would spoil my relationship with them, or their relationship with me. So if there are things they are doing that are wrong, then I'll rebuke them. And if I need to, I will discipline them. But it's not because I hate them, it's not because I want to get rid of them, it's not because I'm going to break the bond between us. It's because of the bond that's there that I rebuke them, I discipline them. And the psalmist says, I know you will do that to me, O Lord. I accept the fact that this suffering that's come into my life is your rebuke. I accept the fact that it's your discipline. I accept the fact that you've brought it in order to teach me things that I needed to learn. Maybe the psalmist has been getting proud, and it takes this sort of trouble to humble him. Maybe the psalmist had been feeling self-sufficient, and it takes this sort of trouble to show him how weak he is. Maybe the psalmist has been a bit unsympathetic towards other people, and he's got to go through some pain now in order to teach him to be sympathetic. But one way or another, he sees it's God who's been teaching him. God has sent this suffering in order to warn him and to discipline him. But it's all in the context of the relationship. He's able to look into heaven and say, Oh God, I know that it's you who's dealing with me, and you're dealing with me as Yahweh. You've not changed since last year, or the year before, or the year before that. You are still my unchanging God. You love me as much now as you did then. So this suffering that's come to me, I can take as an expression of your love. It's a token of the relationship between us. The second thing is this. As someone who has this relationship with God, he can appeal for mercy. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, or discipline me in your wrath. Be merciful to me, Lord. A father will rebuke and discipline his children, but there will be a point beyond which he won't go, because he can't. If he's got a father's heart, if he really has got a relationship of love, there will come a point where he says, I just can't bring myself to hit him again. I can't bring myself to cause him more hurt. There's a point at which the father feels that he must have mercy on him. And the psalmist can appeal to God in that way. He says, because you are Yahweh, just because we have this sort of relationship, be merciful to me, Yahweh. Please don't be angry with me. All right, you've got to rebuke me because there are things in my life that need correcting. All right, you've got to discipline me, I know that. But please don't be angry with me. Please let there be a line drawn. Have you ever had your child come to you and talk to you in that way? He's going to come and admit to you he's done something wrong. And maybe he knows that you're going to punish him. But he still says, Dad, please don't be angry with me. I mean, I know I shouldn't have borrowed the car last night and wrecked it. But please don't be angry with me. He knows that there's going to be rebuke. He knows there's going to be discipline. But he still appeals to you to be merciful. And the psalmist knows he can do that. He can look into the face of God, and he's looking into the face of his Father. Not of a judge sitting in court. He's looking into the face of his Father and saying, please don't be angry. Even if I deserve it, please don't be angry. Please be merciful. And then the third thing is this, that as someone in relationship with God, he can expect pity. Isn't that the reason why he pours out these descriptions of his suffering? I'm faint, he says. My bones are in agony. My soul is in anguish. I'm worn out from groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping. I drench my couch with tears. He's saying to God, just look at me. Look at the state I'm in. And please, please feel some pity. It's not the job of a judge to feel pity, but it's the job of a father to feel pity. And he really believes that Yahweh is the sort of God who feels pity towards his people, the people with whom he has a relationship when they're hurting. He describes his suffering because he knows that Yahweh's character is such that Yahweh will feel pity for him. If he thought of Yahweh as being a cruel, sadistic master, there would be no point in describing his own suffering, would there? Because the master would simply say, good, good, excellent. But no, he knows that when he describes his suffering, Yahweh will feel for him. Because they've got that sort of relationship. Within this relationship that exists between God and his people, God feels for them. God has pity on them. It hurts him to see them hurting. And the psalmist knows that. And the psalmist can appeal to that. And then the fourth thing is this. That as someone who's in covenant with God, as someone who has this relationship with God, he can call on God to maintain the relationship. You see this in a startling way in verse 4, where he says this, turn, O Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. No one remembers you when he is dead. Who praises you from the grave? He asks God to turn back to him. He feels that the Lord has been turning away from him, rebuking him, chastening him. Now he says, come back to me, O Lord. Deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. And those two words, unfailing love in the NIV, are just one word in the Hebrew. And it's a word that always means love within that sort of relationship. Not the love or the attraction you might feel for a stranger, but the love that you have between you and a person with whom you've got a committed relationship. In Tyndale's Bible, it's loving kindness. Some translations it might be covenant love. But the point about it is it's the love that exists between people who are bonded in a relationship. Now he says, save me. Because you've got that sort of love for me. And he says, I can't believe you want me to die. He's so ill that he is approaching death. If God doesn't intervene to change the situation, he'll die. But if he dies, then at least for a time, his ongoing relationship with God will be interrupted. Because when he's in the grave, he won't be remembering God. He won't be in fellowship with God. That was the way that Old Testament believers saw death. They thought of death as a shadowy realm where even believers were cut off from God's presence and fellowship. They knew there was going to be a resurrection, and that on the other side of the resurrection they would rediscover God. But death itself was a very grim thought. Because in death, the relationship between a believer and God would just be sidelined. And so the psalmist says, please don't do that to me. Please don't let me die and fall into Sheol, into the realm of the dead, where our relationship will be interrupted. He wants to carry on living so that he can carry on experiencing the love of God, the nearness of God, his relationship with God. Now, of course, he knows he's going to die one day. But he says, not yet, please. I want to carry on living in the sunshine of your love here in this world, tasting the sweetness of the relationship I've got with you. And no doubt he would add, and oh, please, one day bring me back from the dead, so that the relationship can be resumed in all its fullness. He's looking to God to maintain the relationship. For him, the worst thought is that relationship could ever be broken. He doesn't even want it to be interrupted. And he's sure that God won't break it. And then, fifthly and finally, is this. That as someone who's in that sort of relationship with God, he knows that his prayers will be heard. God does sometimes hear and answer the prayers of people with whom he's got no relationship. Because he's a very kind-hearted God. There are times when wicked people pray because they're in some great trouble, and they ask to be delivered from that trouble, and God, because he's just extraordinarily kind, does rescue them from their trouble. We've all seen examples of that. God is free to do that. God is free to answer the prayers of people with whom he has no relationship. But he doesn't have to, because he's got no relationship with them. In the same way as if in that shop on Castle Street, if the girl behind the till said, oh, could you lend me a fiver for my bus fare tonight? I'm free to lend her a fiver if I want to, but I'm not bound to. I've got no obligation to. But if my son asks me for something which he needs, I don't have the option of saying no, do I? Because I've got that sort of relationship with him. Because we're bonded together. He's got claims on me. The psalmist knows that he's got that sort of relationship with God. If he's in relationship with Yahweh, it means that his prayers will be heard. That in the end is the reason why he's got the assurance he's got in verse 9. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. I know he has, because he's the Lord. It's unthinkable that Yahweh, the unchanging God should just harden his heart and close his ears to the people to whom he's linked himself forever. The Lord accepts my prayer. Yahweh accepts my prayer. Why? Because I've been so eloquent in my praying? No, because he's Yahweh. Because that's his character. Because that's his relationship with me. Because he's the unchanging God. Every believer's prayers are heard. Every believer's prayers are answered. Everyone who is in covenant relationship with God has a cast iron guarantee that all his prayers are heard and answered. You don't always get what you ask for. Again, that's part of the relationship that a wise father has with his children, that he doesn't give them everything they ask for. But he always gives the best. The psalmist thinks it's wonderful to have Yahweh as his God. Yahweh, do not rebuke me or discipline me in your wrath, in your anger. Because you are Yahweh, I can trust you to rebuke me. I can trust you to discipline me when I need it. But Yahweh, because you are Yahweh, because you are the unchanging, merciful, gracious God, I know that you'll be merciful. And because you are Yahweh, that sort of God, I know that you'll pity me. And because you are Yahweh, because you've entered this unbreakable relationship with me, I know that you'll maintain that relationship. And Yahweh, because you're Yahweh, I know that you have heard my prayers and that you will deliver me in due time. Started the service by singing a hymn that I don't think we'd ever sung before. It's a wonderful hymn. Everlasting kindness. Hark, my soul, 'tis he. Thy Jehovah, which is just another form of the name Yahweh. Thy Jehovah, Yahweh Jesus, speaks this word to thee, everlasting kindness. Speak that word once more, O my soul, still listen. Trust it and adore. Everlasting kindness. That's what this psalm's about. A kindness that can't change. A bond that can't be broken. A love that goes on and on and on into all eternity. A love that gives us every guarantee we need. That he'll discipline us. That he'll be merciful to us. That he'll pity us. That he'll maintain the relationship with us. And that he'll answer our prayers. People in this world are always looking for trustworthy relationships. I know that a lot of people say they don't want commitment. I know that a lot of people just jump from one relationship to another and avoid commitment. But I think it's deep down there in the heart of every human being that we know we need people who will always be there for us. We need people who will commit themselves to us irrevocably. Half the pop songs that are sung are about that. About a love that just goes, that is forever. It's what we need. It's what we want. It's what we hanker for. To use a good word. It's there in, built into us that we need relationships that are faithful. Relationships that are trustworthy. There is only one person who can commit himself to you forever and say, I will never leave you nor forsake you. There is only one person with whom such a relationship is possible. My brother, my sister may die. My friends may turn against me. My wife is only my wife till death us do part. Church members will leave, move to other parts of the country. All the relationships I have in this world are only for a time. But the relationship I have with Yahweh is a relationship forever, because he is, and he doesn't change.